Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Gilcrease Museum is presenting an exhibit of work by Thomas Moran that are among the first and best example of mass-produced color printing. Yellowstone and the West, the chromolithographs of Thomas Moran feature a suite of 15 chromolithographs of watercolors by Thomas Moran based on his first travels to Yellowstone and the Rocky Mountains. Today, these prints made by Louis Prang are considered among the finest ever made. Along with the set, Gilcrease will be displaying its own collection of Thomas Moran watercolors, oils, and etchings. My guest today is the author of the catalog and a former Tulsan, art historian Joni Kinsey. She lectured on the collection over the weekend. Kinsey is a professor of American art history at the University of Iowa. Her catalog is titled Thomas Moran's West, Chromolithography, High Art, and Popular Taste. Yellowstone in the West will be on display at Gilcrease through September 8th. Joni Kinsey joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Joni Kinsey, welcome to, back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
And welcome home. This has been your home, and you graduated from the University of Tulsa. And during that time at the University of Tulsa, you had a long time to look at their collection of Thomas Moran. That has been your specialty. And now this new show of the chromolithographs of Thomas Moran. Now, we're familiar with his oil paintings. We're familiar with his watercolors because Gilcrease has a great collection of those as well. What are the chromolithographs? Obviously, it's a print of some sort.
Yes, these are actually quite interesting prints, although they have long been ignored. They were in their day, which was in the 1860s and 70s, and this particular set was produced in the early 1870s, finished as a set in 1876, were extremely unique prints in one sense. They were the state-of-the-art color reproduction prints of their day, and they were important in all sorts of ways, not only for Moran and the producer, the publisher named Louis Prang, but for the American people more generally, chromolithographs were the first color prints that the average person could afford and have on their wall. These were the first kinds of the everyman's art that anybody really could afford. Courier knives had existed before, but technically those are black prints with hand coloring. These chromolithographs are full color prints, so it's a bit of a complicated process in how they were made, but they essentially revolutionized American culture and created a fad for color in all kinds of ways. This particular set has other interesting properties, but chromolithographs are important for their being, at the time, a new technology, color images that anyone could have on their walls, and they really wowed people.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned Courier and Ives, because that was my first thought when I thought of color prints. I thought of the Courier and Ives, because they were using the work of, I think, Dury. I know Dury's from the early 1800s, and of course, Moran from the late 1800s. But what you're saying is this was the first print process, which was color.
That's right.
And it sounds like it was very time intensive.
Extremely so. Just to give a brief summary of the process, lithography, which is still used today both in art schools and in regular printing techniques, although it's been updated, is based on a process of drawing on a very, very fine-grained, smooth limestone block with a grease-based medium. And then essentially based on the principle of oil and water don't mix. And I always say to my students, think about salad dressing and how it separates. You draw with a grease-based pen, pencil, crayon, your image on this stone, and then you wet the stone, and then you ink the stone. And where the stone is simply wet, it will not accept the greasy ink, but the greasy image will accept the greasy ink, and then it is printed. There you get one color, and that's all Courier Knives did, was to print in black, and then they would hand it to a person who would hand color it. Chromolithographs instead have a separate stone for every single color that is in the image. And it's a very, very arduous and specialized process, all done in the day with hand and eye only. There were no mechanical processes here. Someone sat and redrew only the yellows and only the blues and only the greens and so forth on separate stones, and they all had to be perfectly aligned in the printing of those plates to get the colors to match up perfectly. Today, lithography printing is done with color filters and cameras and It's all very mechanical, specialized to the degree that it uses only 4 inks to get a full color image. That was not so refined back then, and the very finest chromolithographs, which this Moran set is, used upwards of 50 separate stones for even one full color image.
And yet you said this was the first printing process that was affordable to the average American. How did they do that if you're talking about such an intensive process?
The investment on the part of the publisher was pretty high. And we know, in fact, that in this case, Prang, Lewis Prang of Boston, had invested somewhere around $25,000 in the printing of this particular set of Thomas Moran's prints. However, the return, like just today, it's bulk. You know, now once the plates are made, they can print off infinite numbers of these and sell them over time and recoup their investment. So it was a very expensive process, but by selling massive numbers of these, they could stand to make a lot of money. Although this particular set is unique in many, many ways. This is not your average chromolithographic image, or this group. Is not your average bear when it comes to chromolithographs. This was a fairly specific and refined limited edition set. They only printed 1,000 copies, and part of that was to raise the value, the perceptions of the value of this set. It was marketed as a high-end special set of prints, and he targeted high-end buyers of high-end artist prints.
And this gives us a sense of how important Moran was in late 1870. He had gone on the expeditions to Yellowstone where the fantastic tales had been coming back about this crazy place with geysers and huge canyons and mountains and abundant wildlife. And people tended not to believe it. And this was sort of the not photographic proof, but the artistic proof.
That's right.
That
in
this
many,
place existed.
In all, yes, to just back up to the circumstances, Yellowstone was essentially unknown, widely anyway, to most people until about 1871, when the first U.S. government expedition went to the Yellowstone, came back with maps, charts, photos, drawings, paintings, big undertaking. And Thomas Moran was on that expedition along with William Henry Jackson, who was a photographer, and their work was certainly widely regarded as the ultimate proof that this strange place really existed. And those pictorial documents were used to convince Congress to set this place aside as the first national park. So that happened in the spring of 1872. The first national park was announced. But even still, most people did not know of or had never seen these images. It was a pretty small group of people, even though Moran was now producing big paintings and the photographs were being seen. Those are still a few in number. This chromolithographic set was one of the first public sorts of documents or groups of images that allowed more people to begin to really appreciate the odd, wondrous strangeness of this incredible place.
And of course, Moran, though, is famous for enhancing his nature. When you go to see the Morans at the Gilcrease, you'll see, you can't really see the canyon from that particular spot. He was making a sort of artistic truth rather than actual truth.
He took a certain amount of artistic
license. And what you see in these chromolithographs is things like Mammoth Hot Springs, which then was known as Gardner's Hot Springs, colors that you would not believe. And this is the other thing about this chromolithographic set. The colors are so heightened. Mm-hmm. It's almost cartoonish or hyper-real, I would say. That was purposeful, wasn't
it? I think
it
was purposeful, yeah. There was a fair amount of discussion in the letters between Prang and Company to Moran and other people about the way in which these were appearing as they were being produced, and they worried a little bit about the color of them. But the thing that people talked about and still talk about with Yellowstone is the vivid color of certain places in Yellowstone. Those hot springs, the Yellowstone Canyon, are indeed extremely colorful, and they were accentuating that to some degree in these prints. At the same time, they were making an impression that this is something worthy of your attention. We want to get your attention.
Was it mainly getting their attention or actually about conserving as well? Was there a conservation message at this particular point?
Surprisingly, it's not as much as you might think. Yeah. The understanding of the place as set aside for conservation purposes came a bit later, although there was some discussion in the early rhetoric of the lobbying campaign to set this place aside as a park. Was that if we don't do it, then squatters will come in, and we need to preserve it. And yet I think there was a lot more of that as a way of convincing Congress to do it more than an environmental concern.
The conservation really comes in with John Muir,
yes,
20,
that's
30
right.
years later.
The impetus to make it a national park, when you really look into it deeply, was in large measure due to the interest of the Northern Pacific Railroad, who wanted that place as a tourist attraction. And in 1872, they were building their line from Minneapolis-St. Paul to Puget Sound, and they were looking for anything that would get people to ride those trains. And that was a big draw, to have this amazing place.
And that's one
that
of the
route.
Little dirty secrets of American
that's
art.
That's one of the interesting dirty secrets, I guess you could say, but it certainly makes it more interesting.
I mean, Bierstadt, Moran, all these guys working in the West were in some measure in cahoots with the railroads.
They were certainly working on behalf of a greater interest on the part of the government, but also on part of business and industry that was expanding to the West, that had a real vested interest in getting people out there and making the most of this territory in every way possible, commercially, through tourism, through mining, through exploration, all kinds of things. And the more publicity that would entice people, the better. And Moran and Bierstadt were not, I think, consciously
Selling out.
Right. They weren't corporate shills, in a sense, but they were very much interested in conveying the wonders of this remarkable place to the broader public.
And making money from selling their artwork.
And making money from selling their artwork, absolutely. Yeah.
My guest today is Joni Kinsey, a professor of American art history at the University of Iowa. She's the author of the catalog Thomas Moran's West, Chromolithography, High Art and Popular Taste, which was actually published a number of years ago. It's being reintroduced with this show, Traveling, mm-hmm. again. And Yellowstone in the West, the Chromolithographs of Thomas Moran, is on display through September 8th. Now, what is spectacular about this particular set of chromolithographs?
There are so many interesting things about this particular set. And first, in general, about the aspirations of Prang, and then more specifically about the particular prints we're seeing at the Gilcrease. Prang took a lot of criticism for these remarkable chromolithographs that he was producing by many different artists, not the Moran set per se. He started producing chromolithographs for the average public after the Civil War, in the wake of the Civil War, and he refined the process, and there were many other chromolithographers at the time, but as many people noted even then, if chromolithographs are mentioned, it is Prang's that are meant. He was the most significant, widely recognized, prolific publisher of these prints. He published two in 1868, in particular, that he made thousands of dollars on. One was a print called The Barefoot Boy by Eastman Johnson, and another was a group of chickens, picture of chickens by Arthur Fitzwilliam Tate. He made over $10,000 a piece on, that was profit, on each of those prints. And these were for about $5 a piece to the average person. So you can put the math together and figure out how many he sold. These were enormously popular prints with the average person. The art critics at first thought this was a wonderful thing, that this was going to put art in front of the people and give people a sense of what art could be and elevate their taste and teach them things. The better the pictures got, the more concerned they got, which might seem very strange at first, but remember, these are high art critics. They had a vested interest in what you might call the distinctions between real art, original art, and mere fakes, copies, reproductions, that they worried could fool the public into believing that these were just as good. Most people thought they were just as good. Prang said, if you can't afford an original, this is just as good. And he had a really strong educational purpose in this. The critics got very, very concerned and started really launching a major campaign against chromolithographs in the late 1860s, because the more popular they got, the more worried the high-end critics, the high-end artists, the high-end collectors got that their originals would be devalued.
Now, today we think of printmaking as an art form just as valid as painting or sculpture mm-hmm. or any other sort of high art. But at that time, was printmaking considered a craft
Original printmaking, where the artist makes the plate and prints the print, was still valued as an art form. These are not that.
These are almost industrial.
These are industrial. These are reproductive prints. These are like posters today. And we don't pay too much for posters. That's what they really are. The 1870s version of nice quality posters. But these were new at the time, and it took a while for people to sort out the distinctions between their value and that of originals. And that's where the critics came in and started to say, these are not the same thing. Don't be fooled. So Prang got a lot of criticism, and this particular set that he commissioned from Moran was envisioned by him as a way of refuting those critics. This was going to be a high-end set in a special box, marketed in a limited edition, just the way original artist prints that artists themselves make would be. And as such, he priced it accordingly. This was a very expensive set in its day, $60 in 1876, which amounts to about $1,000 or even a little more
so
today.
This one, your average.
This is not your average. Right. The average person is not buying this set. They hope to market this group to people like Queen Victoria and the President of the United States. Lots and lots of famous people and high-end art collectors. This was not sold in your average bookstore.
Was Moran making money off this as well? Because you mentioned these artists, and Prang was making
sure.
a lot of money off this. Were the artists getting their...
Moran was paid around $150 to $200 per watercolor, and then his involvement was finished. He did not get any commissions, any royalties off the sale of these prints. That was a commissioned project, and then he was finished.
Now, one thing, when you see these chromolithographs compared to similar images that Moran did in oil and in watercolor, what you see is the colors are so much more heightened.
Mm-hmm.
You would think with reproductions, the idea is to mirror the original as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
This is taking it to another level, isn't
it?
Well,
one of the things that we've tried to do, and you'll see to some degree in the Gilcrease exhibition, is the watercolors, the originals, next to the chromolithographs. The Gilcrease is actually extremely fortunate. The people of Tulsa are extremely fortunate to have one of Thomas Moran's original watercolor sets still intact. It's the only one that's still intact. It's not the set he produced for Prang, but the Blackmore set at the Gilcrease, which he produced for a man named William Blackmore, was done almost exactly at the same time. It's very, very similar in both style, technique, and even subject matter. So it makes a great comparison to this chromolithographic set. And you will see, if you go to the exhibition, that the watercolors themselves are very colorful. The chromolithographs, because they did use different kinds of inks, they were redrawn by this special artist at the Prang factory, do have a little more intensity. But again, I think that was to emphasize both the wonders of chromolithography, the wonders of Yellowstone National Park and its coloration, and in general, the kind of wonder of the color reproductive printmaking world.
Yeah. And of course, these prints are really some of the finest examples of that, the sketchings that he did that he immediately brought back east and started making paintings and mm-hmm. and watercolors mm-hmm. from, too. And you'll see some very interesting images. One is of a river valley, and you're supposed to be somewhere around Yellowstone, but it looks like it's Red Rock from Utah.
Well, indeed. The set originally was called the Yellowstone Park and the region, the mountain regions of Colorado. I maybe get this order wrong, but Colorado, Wyoming, Nevada, and California, or something to that degree, in Utah, that
yeah.
was it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it isn't just Yellowstone. There, the majority of the prints are Yellowstone subjects, but then there's a whole group of them that are other places in Colorado and Nevada and Utah. And so
Mount of the Holy Cross
is there. The area now known as Zion National Park, the Great Salt Lake of Utah. There's a Sierra Nevada scene. as well as all these Yellowstone pictures. Prang was really interested in both capturing people's attention about these places in the West, but certainly kind of piggybacking on the recent fame of the new Yellowstone National Park.
Well, so what was the reaction from the general public when these chromolithographs came out? Was it a success? Did people say, wow, this is, we have to go visit, or what exactly?
Well, certainly tourism was beginning to increase. It didn't really fully get going until 1883 when the railroad reached the park. In 76, it was still pretty remote. Most people couldn't get there.
There were Indian wars.
There was nothing there. There were still Indians around, all kinds of things that prevented people from just getting on some sort of transportation and getting out there. But it did heighten their interest. And back to your question about the set and its reception, Prang did not release this to the general public. I think it would have been wildly, enthusiastically approved, acclaimed, and regarded had he done so. He marketed it instead to a very elite group of people who were not prepared to embrace this mechanical, industrialized process. And he was pricing it quite high. So there was a real struggle to get people to buy it. They became rather desperate to sell them. And by the end of the first year, they had either given away and sold very few. Only 50 sets were out in private hands out of 1,000. No one was buying this set. In the fall of 1876, there was a fire at the Prang factory. We don't know what caused it, but most of the surviving sets were destroyed, and there were a handful of single images left, which greatly reduced the number that we have today. It has become an extremely rare commodity today. Partly that's the reason it's not so well known. There's only maybe 50, 60 sets around in the world, and we just don't know. Prang was heavily insured, and he got his money back, which is very interesting and coincidental. And I certainly don't want to cast aspersions, but it is a remarkable story that this particular group of prints that were so highly hoped would redeem Prang's reputation as an important printmaker, ultimately were a kind of colossal failure. But that makes them more rare and more valuable today. It's a wonderful, interesting story.
You know, it's interesting. You know, if you were a high-end collector at that point, he was wanting $60 for the set. Mm-hmm. You could get an original Moran watercolor for probably $100, $150,
exactly,
which is
right.
what he charged.
That's exactly right.
Prang.
And you certainly could buy a lot of original prints for that,
yeah,
that the artist had made and printed himself. So it is an interesting story in the history of reproductions, the history of imagery generally. We tend today to just accept that color print is all around us. Color printing is everywhere. This was the moment at which that first became possible. And it was something that people struggled with. How are we going to embrace this? What are we going to think about these prints? Are they real in the sense of real art? Are they simply cheap fakes? Are they somewhere in between? And what does that do to our notion of an original work of art? All of that was in flux at this time. And these chromos play a big part in that story.
Yellowstone in the West, the chromolithographs of Thomas Moran are on display at Gilcrease Museum through September 8th. My guest today is Joni Kinsey, a professor of American art and history at the University of Iowa and author of the catalog, which has been re-released now, which you did in the mid-2000s, I think.
Yeah, this exhibition was planned back then, mm-hmm, and the book was written then, and for a number of mainly financial reasons, it was postponed, and it is finally now being launched, and I'm very happy about that. One other thing about the particular set that's on display here at the Gilcrease is that some people will notice in some of those prints that there are what are called registration marks on both sides of the image, and in a couple of instances, pencil notations. This is not one of the original boxed sets that Prang sold. This is an assembled set that has been acquired and put together more recently from some of those single sheets that survived the fire. That is really interesting. if people will look closely, they are seeing what are the publisher's proofs with those special notations. The little notations on the side say things like more color here or less black there. You're seeing some really important working documents for the production of that set in this grouping on display at Gilcrease.
So how close are they to the final finished product?
They're pretty close. Uh-huh. They're pretty close.
So you're talking about minute little changes here.
Very minute, yeah. Uh-huh.
I want to switch gears in our last couple of minutes. Now, you've been at the University of Iowa for a number of years, and while you did your dissertation on Thomas Moran, and you're a great Moran scholar, you've been doing a lot on Grant Wood. Of course, that's the Iowa native son. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Grant Wood is this... It's this interesting figure. He's sort of misunderstood because he's so well known for one image, American Gothic, which art critics have written volumes on. What interests you about Grant Wood?
Oh, this is so fun. There is a connection in a way between my interest in Moran and these things we've just been talking about and Grant Wood, because both of them have an incredible popular appeal. And yet at the same time, as we've just been talking about the chromos, that popular appeal has in some cases complicated their position as important artists, and that's no more true than for Grant Wood. Today he is still much beloved, as he was in the 1930s, for his rural portrayals of his home region of Iowa, which I now live in, and the sometimes satirical, sometimes funny, sometimes witty, sometimes heartfelt and really quite genuinely sincere.
You look at his lithographs, are all about, you know, working the land.
Portrayals of real people and landscapes that he loved very much.
And yet, for art critics, he's known for American Gothic, which has to have some sort of satirization or belittling it. But you look at his body of work, and it's mainly, he's extolling the virtues of middle America and small town farmers and people working hard.
He was a native Iowan. He believed in Iowa. He believed in the Midwest. He believed in people who work the land and that land that we live in, this heartland of America, and wanted people to recognize that there was something of value there that lived beyond that region. And he painted what he knew. He was proud of that, and he wanted people to appreciate that. Not everybody did. The high-end modernists were really quite scorning of his work, and he suffered a lot in his time for that. But I think, you know, time has shown that he did some things that really do stand the test of time and are, you know, nobody knows better American Gothic than people today. You know, it's I think, been called the most second famous painting in the world next to the Mona Lisa or the Last Supper, mm-hmm. and that really tells you something, that he was showing us something we need to be
attentive to. Are you at work on any new work on Grant Wood?
I am. I just, in fact, last week finished an article for an exhibition catalog that's going to be opening in the fall in Iowa that has very much to do with that dispute about what is the future of modern art in the 1930s. What would be the future for those people then? There was a huge debate whether it would be the regionalism, the American scene imagery that the 1930s was preoccupied with, or would it be modernist abstraction and other things that we know, of course, did rise to prominence. There was a heated debate over it, and Grant Wood was right in the thick of it.
We wish you success with that.
Thank you.
And Yellowstone in the West on display all summer long at Gilcrease Museum. Joni Kinsey, thanks very much for joining us. Art historian Joni Kinsey speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She's a professor of American art history at the University of Iowa and author of the catalog Thomas Moran's West, Chromolithography, High Art, and Popular Taste. The exhibit Yellowstone and the West, the chromolithographs of Thomas Moran, continues on display at Gilcrease Museum through September 8th. More information at gilcrease.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.